Ba-ba-ba-da-bow. Ladies and gents, welcome back to Aid Thompson and Other Disappointments, your twice, sometimes thrice, weekly delve into all things news, politics, dystopia, and all things shit. Cheers. How you doing? Grab yourself a beer. Roll up whatever it is that you need to roll up to self-medicate your way through another hour-long delve. Gallivant into gallows humour with myself, yours truly, Aid Thompson. This is the last pre-recorded show before the big live one. This coming Friday, it's at Tower Hill, Tower Gateway, all around that sort of neck of the woods. St. Catherine Docks, I think, is another part of Tower Hill, isn't it? That's the posh part. And we're doing a live show. It's myself, Danny fucking Price, Marina Perkis, Dane Baptiste, James Bennison. It's going to be a good time, man. I'm looking forward to it. That's this coming Friday night, 7 o'clock. There's still some tickets available if you want to jump on funk-27. That's my website, funk-27.co.uk/shows. You can grab yourself a ticket there. What are we going to talk about today? There's so much going on. We've got Keir Starmer suffering a front bench resignation in the shape of Imran Hussein. Don't know if you guys have heard about this already. I'm assuming that you have done. It's apparently an earthquake tearing through the very fabric of the Labour Party. I did a TikTok this morning, sort of ripping and roasting into this idea that one resignation is some sort of earth-shattering, dramatic moment for the Labour Party. For Keir Starmer, what does it say about his leadership? Is this tearing the Labour Party apart? Guys. I mean, look, there could be other resignations. This could be the beginning of a really, really awkward time for Keir Starmer. This could be the moment that he fucks it all up. You know, he's been enjoying this 25-point lead for months. Just dancing around Labour HQ, no doubt. This could be the moment it all goes wrong for Sir Keir Starmer. But it could also be just like a resignation from a principled member of his team who just couldn't, within good conscience, he just couldn't stand there and just say nothing. So he's resigned. But then, you know, to a greater or lesser extent, things just carry on as normal. It could be that too. And the TikTok I was doing this morning, I'll just sort of quickly touch on some of the points, because not everyone's on TikTok. And you know what? Even the people who aren't seeing my content. But I'm not bitter. I will not go into a hour-long rant about how frustrating I find it that the app on which I built my very modest following, the app that served me pretty good, getting my head above the parapet, and gaining me some exposure, and to some extent growing my podcast. I will not rant in a bitter fashion for 1 hour about how they appear to be ferociously restricting my reach. But yes, even the people who follow me on TikTok may not have seen some of the talking points. So I'll quickly, you know, walk you through them now. I mean, basically what I was saying was, whenever there's a scandal, or not even a scandal, whenever there's some sort of very slight problem for the Labour Party, or indeed for its leader, it is blown up in like until it's lost all sense of proportion versus how the same thing is handled when something happens within conservative circles, within the Conservative Party. And this is just like the latest example of this. Is like when a Labour front bencher resigns in protest over Sir Keir Starmer's stance and tacit support of the Israeli state's bombing campaign across Gaza. When a front bencher resigns on those terms, it is reported by Sky News, the BBC, everyone on Twitter. It is reported like it's some sort of existential crisis for the Labour Party. If you saw the way Sky were reporting this morning, and I noticed Alex Andreo picked up on this also, it is so overhyped. It's like, if one more minister resigns, this could spell deep, deep trouble for Sir Keir Starmer. Could it though? Really? Why is this going to be some big existential problem if one or maybe two Labour front benches resign? Like, everything's always way worse when it's a Labour-related story, isn't it? Like, one of the things I was saying earlier on one of my videos was, like, when it's Labour, when it's anti-Semitism, it's like 7 or 8 people lost their jobs. They were councillors, a couple of MPs, over suspicions that they were being anti-Semitic. I'm not here to say whether that was anti-Semitism or it wasn't anti-Semitism. I'm just saying that the perception was that 7 or 8 of them were being sufficiently anti-Semitic that it was described as rife and endemic. And all these questions floating out from blogs and articles and LBC radio phone-ins. Left, right and centre, it was like, does Labour have an anti-Semitism problem? Labour's cultural anti-Semitism problems. Then you pan out a bit and you're like, how many Conservative MPs, not councillors, actual Conservative MPs have been suspended or fired or lost a whip or been prosecuted for sexual assault, sexual harassment or actual rape? And nobody ever asked the question, oh, does the Conservative Party have a rape problem? You know, you never hear that, do you? There's no head honcho at the top of the Conservative Party committing, promising to root out the rapers in the Conservative Party. Oh, we're going to take this seriously. We're going to root out this cultural endemic rife problem. There's no place for it in the modern Conservative. You're not hearing any of that shit, are you? It's all just like, oh, well, I'm sorry about those rapers over there. But anyway, over here, everything's normal over here. We don't have any sort of problem. But look over there. Look, Labour have got a front bencher that's resigned. It's tearing themselves apart. Anyway. You get the idea. It's just handled differently, isn't it? Imran Hussein resigns in protest at Starmer's stance. 10 Labour councillors resign in protest at Labour's stance. What is this? Like, Sky News this morning, I saw a clip where they were, like, asking Keir Starmer. He's behind this podium, and this woman, like, puts up a hand. She's like, she goes, Sir Keir Starmer, is it accurate to say that this situation is tearing your party apart? Like, are we really that? Are we there yet? Really? This feels early for it to be tearing Labour apart. And not only that, the whole thing is ridiculous. Like, this idea that Sir Keir Starmer, that his voice, that his stance is in any way going to impact the actual stance of the Israeli state is just lunacy. Like, do you publicly distance yourself from Israel's bombing campaign? What is your stance? Do you condemn Israel for their bombing campaign, Sir Keir? Why won't you call for a ceasefire that they definitely won't pay any attention to you whatsoever about? You're not even the Prime Minister. You're the leader of the opposition in a cut adrift, tiny island, thousands of miles away. But do you demand a ceasefire? Well, I don't know. I'm not really sure what my stance is. I'll ask me next week. Like, nobody gives a shit what his stance is. He's not the Prime Minister, and we're miles and miles away. We left the main geopolitical block that we used to have a seat at the head table for, so nobody gives a fuck what we think anymore. Certainly not the leader of the opposition. But as I said on this morning's TikTok, that you definitely won't have seen, even if you follow me on TikTok, but I'm not bitter. Not bitter. I'm not going to go down that whole Robbie Williams trajectory. Like, do you remember that period? I get in trouble, man. Like, when I'm trying to make a serious, salient point about the state of politics in the UK, and indeed the Western world, and indeed the Middle East. And God knows you've got to be really careful about how on point and delicate and sensitive and gentle you make your points when you're talking about the Middle East. But I get in trouble because I always go down the road of, like, pop culture references. You know, people are, like, walking on eggshells, like, oh, how do I articulate my feelings about Israel and Gaza? Meanwhile, I'm just like, yeah, it's a bit like Nirvana and Pearl Jam back in the day, isn't it? Anyway. But I don't want to, like, insofar as my bitterness with TikTok is concerned, it's a bit like, do you remember, like, when Robbie Williams was delisted from Radio 1? Do you remember that? And it's fair to say I don't think he took that very well. And I remember, like, the controller of Radio 1, whoever it was back in that day, like, they released a statement because Robbie Williams went up at the Brit Awards or something. He accepted an award and he made some sort of bitter comment about, like, oh, you know, I guess the kids do like me, huh, Radio 1, or like something like that. And the controller of Radio 1 was like, look, you know, nobody's saying that he's not good. Of course he's good. He sold millions of albums. He's one of the most successful artists that Britain has produced in the last, like, 20 or 30 years. Obviously, Robbie's amazing. However, if you ask kids these days from, you know, and Radio 1 is primarily a children's station, whether we like to admit that or not, you know, age 15 to 23 is probably their demographic. If you ask kids who they're listening to at that point, they probably wouldn't say Robbie Williams. His albums that he was releasing at that point, and the thing about, like, Party Like a Russian, do you remember that single that he came out with? The songs he was coming out with and the albums, Swing While You're Winning, all that, they were there to placate and satisfy existing Robbie fans who loved him when he was in Take That and shortly afterwards. They're not going to win him any new... Anyway, look, this is a really long-winded way of me saying, I don't want to go down that Robbie Williams route, you know? More power to TikTok. Keep doing what you're doing. Love it. Love the video editor thing in the app, but I'm just feeling somewhat frustrated that it's the app that I grew my following on, and it appears that it is now frustrating my reach quite substantially. Anyway, what the fuck was I talking about now? Israel and Gaza. Oh, and Keir Starmer, right. So everyone's, like, pushing him to demand a ceasefire, like he has any power or influence with which to demand a ceasefire. Meanwhile, the actual Prime Minister and the actual Secretary of State for Defence, Grant Shapps, where the fuck are they? Who's demanding that they demand a ceasefire? The people who actually have maybe some smidgen, some sniff of influence. Literally no one is asking. Nobody's... Where are the headlines? Like, is Sunak demanding... Where does Sunak sit on this matter? When is he going to demand a ceasefire? Nobody's asking that. What are they reporting on Sunak about? They're just, you know, plugging in the DSLR cameras, shoving a mic in his face, and they're going... So, Prime Minister, what did you make of Elon Musk? Did you two hit it off? Did you? Oh, you did. Oh, well, that is wonderful. Anyway, that's it. That's it from me here at the O2, where Rishi Sunak had a lovely time with Elon Musk. Yeah, I do enjoy my job as a quote-unquote journalist. God, the state of this fucking country. Anyway, what else is going on? It's November the 8th. Today, as I'm recording this, it's one day after my 43rd birthday. 43 years old. And as I worked out yesterday, if the average age that a British man lives to these days is 86, then I have just reached halfway. How about that shit? It's cause for a celebration, I think. I mean, you're supposed to celebrate on your birthday anyway, right? But it's, you know, to have reached the halfway point is like, you know, it's all downhill from here. And I don't mean like as downhill as in disappointments, you know, although that would be rather on brand for this show. I mean downhill like it's just smooth sailing, coasting. You know, the uphill struggle is very much in the rearview mirror now, I feel. Because if you work it out mathematically, the last few years of your life You're not really, you know. I mean, some people maintain all of their faculties and they're able to coherently hold a conversation with their nearest and dearest right up until they snuff it. And maybe that'll be you. But I have had way too much alcohol and drugs and various other things in my life. I think I'm on borrowed time as it is. Some might say they've noticed the mental effects of my rampant drug use in my 20s already. Maybe I really am on a sort of downward keel in that respect. But if you consider that the last few years of your life, like, are you really even fully there for them? And indeed, are they even really worth living? If you're asleep most of the time, sat in your own freshly shitted pants, you can barely talk, you know? You could just about gurgle and burp the nurse over to change your underwear. You know, it's not a pleasant time, I don't think. I think you could credibly describe what I'm telling you now as a sort of, you know, a spoiler. You know, we all know how bad it gets for the last, like, 10 years. So the last 10 years were basically a write-off. Then you've got all of the years before that where half of it you're fucking asleep. So all of that's out the window. So I think, like, all I'm saying is that if you subtract all the time that you're asleep, and if you take away the years that are frankly not really worth living, then you probably could equate, like, I'm about 75% done. You know, I've only got 25% more time of this fucking charmless shit heap left that I have to endure before I'm out of this motherfucker forever. And that is the reason I'm actually celebrating. Woo! Many happy returns, Aid. Cheers, he says, taking a nice big swig of his coffee. I can't be doing, like, the midweek drinking anymore. I just can't, you know. I used to do this show after, you know, two or three beers, get myself fired up. But ever since I had that sort of throat scare, which I won't, you know, I'm not going to go into details with that again. If you want to know more about it, listen to it like two or three episodes back. But now it's sort of, you know, I'm out of the phases of being really scared about it. But it did worry me and it did make me think I need to actually maybe tone it down. So, like, Friday nights, I'll have a beer with whoever the guest is. But Tuesday, Wednesday, you know, like the solo show, I can't be just sat here knocking back beer after beer after beer, you know, coming inside the house afterwards. Like, Daddy, why are you stumbling all over the place? Can you read me a bedtime story? No. I've just had half a bottle of vodka and I've been ranting about the apocalypse for the last 90 minutes. And you want a story, do you, son? Here's a fucking story. Once upon a time, there were two concurrent world wars over the few remaining fossil fuels that actually were left that were going to run out anyway. We're all fucking doomed. You're going to be devoured by cannibals and I will be harvested for my bones that the cannibals will use to build longbows. The fucking end. Sweet dreams. And my girlfriend's going to be like, hey! Don't talk to him. I'll be like, oh, here comes the fun police. You know, it's not healthy. You gotta tone down that sort of Tuesday night drinking if you can. I mean, I see that sort of behaviour and, you know, rantiness, drunken tomfoolery. It's very much a sort of weekend headliner, I think, in our house. The Friday night special. I mean, the weird thing about, like, toning down the midweek drinking when you host a show like this, which is sort of anarchic, you know, irreverent, bit nutty at times. Once you remove the alcohol from the situation, but the content stays broadly the same, there's something like kind of funny about, you know, imagining people listening to this show and being like, hang on a second, is this him sober? It's like, I thought the whole time the reason that he was so weird and nutty was because he was half cut. Because he was like three craft ales, super strength 6.5% craft ales deep. I mean, who wouldn't be a bit crazy? You turn the mic on after you're dosed up like that, crazy shit's going to come out of your mouth. You're telling me that this is him sober? It's like you and all of your friends, like, join for an intervention, you know? And your friend is sat in the middle of the circle of chairs and your friend has to listen to the impact that their drinking has had on the rest of you. And you all go one by one. You pass the cushion of support around the circle. And whoever's holding the cushion gets to speak that moment. And there's one person here going like,
I just remember like when you turned up drunk to my engagement party and you started saying that really horrible stuff. You were talking about like a really disgusting story. You just have it.
And then, the person sat there and they're like, oh God, I'm so embarrassed that I don't even remember that. And then the cushion goes around to the next person. And they're like,
yeah, I used to work with you. And I remember you came in late one morning, but you were supposed to help me with the forklift, James. You were too hungover to drive the forklift. And I had to stay an extra 3 hours to do all the work that you said that you were going to do. And then I missed my daughter's birthday. That's the impact that your drinking has had on me and my family and my daughter.
And then he's like, oh, God, I'm so sorry. I'm really embarrassed. And yes, I fell short that time. And then it gets around to the third person. The cushion passes over to them. And they're like,
oh, I remember when you turned out to my birthday party and you tipped over the drinks and you called my wife a cunt. And then you punched my dad in the face and you said he was a goggle-eyed prick. And you said you told him all my secrets. All the stuff that I told you in confidence, Aid. You told him my secrets and I've never repaired my relationship with my father. And then he passed away last month and we had never rebuilt that bridge. And that's all down to you and your drinking, Aid.
And then you lean forward and you go, yeah, I was sober that day, actually.
You're talking what?
I feel like that's this podcast. Is you're going to remove the alcohol from the weekday solo thing. And everyone's going to be like, oh my God. So it wasn't the alcohol at all. He's actually like that. Wow. All right. Anyway, what else is in the news? Let's try and drag this kicking and screaming back into the realms of news and current affairs. You may have noticed that it is once again poppy season. Whether you've been watching the news, whether you've been on Twitter and you've seen people abusing and sort of social media accosting people for not sort of showing their poppy sufficiently, or it's it's a weird time, isn't it, in Britain, when the same people who got so offended if you just asked them nicely to wear a mask, if you just asked them nicely, would you mind like wearing a mask? I don't know the science of it, but I would feel safer if you were wearing a mask when you came into the care home, for the benefit of the other residents. Would you just mind, possibly, maybe? If I say please 1,000 times, could you consider wearing a mask? How dare you tell me what I have to wear? Don't tell me what I have to wear. This isn't North Korea. What about my civil liberties? All those same people who got so pearl-clutchingly offended when you asked them to wear their poppy are now the same people who were like, where's your poppy? You wear that poppy, son. You better wear it. That poppy's got a seat at this table before you do. All right? That poppy means more to this family than you do. It's so outrageously hypocritical and weird and gesture politicsy and... what's the phrase that they always come out with? They always say it's virtue signalling when other people wear... if you wear like an AIDS awareness... red ribbon, they would say that was virtue signaling. If you share a black square on your Instagram to show that you are aware and you care about police brutality to black people, that you're aligned with the goals of Black Lives Matter, that you're just aware, you just know what's going on and you want to show some support in some, whatever sort of small and very, very modest way, they would see that as virtue signalling. And yet, give them a few months for May to get to November. And then it's like, where's your fucking poppy? Like, have any of you guys, have you ever lived in a military town? That's my question to you. Were this a sort of LBC, James O'Brien radio phone-in? Which, of course, it is not. This is very much a non-transactional, non-radio phone-in political show. The conversation here is one way. But if any of you have lived in a military town, it is the most weird, hyperbolic, overblown, super hyped thing. This poppy period. Like, it doesn't just last like for a couple of weeks in November. There are, at my son's school, there are silhouettes of soldiers blacked out that stay in the infant school bit the whole year round. I mean, granted, it could be that the school's budget has crumbled along with the concrete to such an extent that they just can't afford to pay somebody to be a groundskeeper to, like, walk through, like, the, you know, garden-y kind of walkway bit. Oh, we should probably take that shit down, you know. Like, it's just as likely that there's still Christmas decorations up all around the school just because they can't afford to pay somebody to get up a ladder and then pull the shit down and change it for an Easter bunny and then change it again for a few soldiers. I accept that that is perfectly likely. However, I actually think this is, you know, it's just fucking weird all year round. And then when it gets into, like, it's like Poppymas, you know, it's not Christmas, it's not Easter, it's Poppymas. It becomes a sort of 2-week festival in a military town. That's the school. You drive through the town centre, there's poppies everywhere. Giant fucking poppies. It's like Day of the Triffids. Driving through the town centre, it's just big, like, overhanging red poppies just bending down, staring at you like they're massive fucking flowery streetlights, you know? And it's weird because, like, being the sort of person I am, being quite sort of, you know, downbeat, always looking for the negative, hence the vibe of this show, you know, the ranting, picking out problems, highlighting hypocrisies, talking about the end of the world. Because of the kind of mentality that I have, there is a little part of me, dear listeners, that would love to just fill up a, you know, like those garden, like, canisters. It looks a bit like, you know, Ghostbusters, like, like pack, backpack thing. I'd love to fill one up with, like, weed killer and just, like, do drive-by shootings, like, drive through the town, like, hosing down poppies. Even though they're not real poppies, just for the visage of it. Just to see how fucking annoyed I could get people who, when they enter a room, they're already at, it like, a 7 or 8 out of 10 angry at somebody not wearing a poppy. So what? How angry could I get them? Could I get them to the point where they anger wank over the visage of me hosing down their poppy with a load of weed killer? Like, how angry could I get them? Is a question that inhabits my brain. Like I said, this is, you know, and this is me sober. I mean, look, I fully support the original thoughts, feelings, spirit of the poppy campaign. I think obviously people who gave their lives, not even the ones that died, how about the people who, like, lost a couple of legs? Like, there's a guy takes his daughter to school at my son's school, and he's got a prosthetic leg, and he was a soldier, because this is a military town and everybody appears to be sort of connected to the army in some way, shape or form, except for us. But he's lost his leg. And I really feel for him, you know, because he's given something, like, he's given a limb to the freedom of, or to the memory of his country. You know, there's great fucking integrity in that sort of sacrifice. And I absolutely support the spirit of the poppy campaign to never forget the atrocities of the world wars, of the sacrifice. Not even, like, the people who died. What about the families that were impacted by, like, the empty chair at Christmas where their dad or son used to sit? I fully stand behind all of that. Where I get off the bus is this sort of fetishization of what that war or those wars were. You know? When it stops being about remembrance and a somber appetite to, like, never forget, lest we forget the horrors of the war, the poppies in the field where the soldiers' bodies laid, When it stops being that and it starts becoming, we won the war. We won the war with a poppy flying over here and a Union Jack flapping over there. We won the war. We are Britain. Britannia rules the waves. Poppy, poppy, Union Jack over here. You know, the red arrows flying over the top. King Charles over in the corner. Boris Johnson flying in on a cable car, spaffing real ale into some fake tits on fucking Isabel Oakeshott or something, who's wearing like a Jerry Halliwell Brits dress, obviously, you know? We won the war. We won the war. Britannia rules the waves. You know, when it becomes that, that vom-bom of British exceptionalism and contorted history and, you know, everyone in a 5-mile radius is just riddled with British Legionnaires' disease. You know, like, then I'm sorry, that at that point I get off the bus. I get off your, you know, weird double-decker, £350 million a week, Brexity poppy-laden bus. I just do. Then I'm like, unless you're making heroin out of the poppies so I can jack myself up and be numb to all of this, then you can fuck off. You know? Now I'm going to get all of the Nige fans in the comments now, you know, all of the avid keeping up with the Farageans. Like, oh, excuse me, excuse me, Aid, you're being very unpatriotic. I'll be like, no, excuse me, while I kiss the sky. Fucking bellends. I don't know, man. Excuse me. Get myself very fired up today. I mean, look, I'll say this, right? There's another campaign going. I think it's the White Poppy campaign. And the idea is very simple. Sort of taps exactly into my sort of concerns with the Red Poppy or the traditional poppy campaign. Which is like you wear a white poppy and then it's supposed to not have any of the connotations of glorification of war. It's not supposed to be tied into any particular like nationality or like flag waving or anything. It's just about peace and the recognition of the horrors of war. It's supposed to take it right back to the original spirit of the original campaign. So if you are so inclined, if you want to pay some respect to the fallen, to you know, the sacrifices that they made, I would encourage you to get involved with the White Poppy campaign. Maybe I should put my money where my mouth is, and I'll jump on that. I'll share a link to it actually on Twitter in a minute. Right, what else is going on? We'll do one more story, try to make sense of the senseless, one more, and then I better get the fuck out of here. There were a couple of polls released this week over in the United States that suggest that Donald Trump, if you're listening to this in the UK, this is going to blow your fucking mind. Donald Trump is leading Joe Biden by like 10 points. In some places, in some key battleground states. Donald Trump is the preferred candidate over Joe Biden. Even though he tried to upend democracy, even though he tried to persuade Mike Pence to not swear in Joseph Biden after winning the 2020 election, even though he is currently indicted, I think 90 times, 90 separate indictments ongoing, with a very real possibility that he could be serving jail time before he even gets elected president. He's leading Joe Biden. Which really makes you think, doesn't it? It makes you think, like, I mean, I've spoken before about suffering from imposter syndrome, sort of low self-worth, low self-esteem. Perhaps that manifests in me hosting things like podcasts where I'm so hungry, nay thirsty, for internet adulation to fill the gap that I never truly filled with familial love. However, if you have imposter syndrome or you feel a little bit, you know, insecure or whatever, spare a thought for Joe Biden. Because look at the guy that he's up against trying to steal elections. Some say inciting a riot on January the 6th in which, was it, 6 people died? Like, spare a thought for that motherfucker. Because it's hard. Sometimes finding out that you're not where you were, that is a hard, humbling experience. I know. But imagine, like, it must be like finding out that your wife left you, right? And you feel shit about that, but you can't blame her. You know, you're not overly surprised that your wife left you because, you know, you're you, right? Like, would you stick around and live with you, right? But then you find out that she left you for a 19-stone, 54-year-old, toothless Uber driver called Clive. You know, you'd be like, I know I'm not perfect, but I'm better than that. Really? Him? Jesus. That must be some humbling American apple pie for Joe Biden to swallow. Or for Joe Biden to have pre-chewed and then handed to him to swallow. Do you think he's still got his faculties about him? Do you think he's fit for, like, to be president, guys? Dear listeners. Because this seems to be the recurring topic, the narrative that people keep going back to, is this idea that he's in cognitive decline, that he stumbles, that he's tripped over here and there, that he doesn't look like a strong, you know, determined leader. And even though Donald Trump is only, was it 4 years younger than him? Donald Trump comes across like he's very much in command of his faculties. Although I think, actually, just to be fully, you know, balanced as best I can be, I think there is footage of Donald Trump sort of forgetting roughly where he is in his speech. But you know what? Like, everyone does that. You know, I'm no Trump fan by a long shot, but I don't think it's fair that you can compare Trump with Biden or suggest that they are on the same keel with regards to their faculties when there's so many documented examples of Joe Biden really, you know, struggling. Plus all the stuff about how he goes to bed early, you know. So it seems to be this idea has sort of gathered pace that Joe Biden maybe should have passed on the idea of going for a second term. Now, my sort of feel about this, my sense for what it's worth is, so I, first off, I do think he should have passed. I think he was what the Democratic Party needed at that time, and he was able to surf into the White House to a greater or lesser extent, purely on the back of the strength of feeling, the depth of feeling against Donald Trump back in 2019 and 2020. You know, it's often sort of minimized or trivialized this idea that people are not voting for, let's say, Labour over here. They're not voting for Labour. They're voting against the Tories. Or they didn't come out to vote for Labour. It's just that the Tory voters just stayed home. I always feel like that is taking something away from the victor. If you got the most votes, you won, you know? Like when, I mean, look, we'll get back onto Trump and Biden in a second, but when the Labour voters stayed home in the Red Wall, it was spun, narrative-wise, as though Boris Johnson had won over all of these former Labour Red Wall, voters. It was absolutely championed as some sort of big, like, landmark victory for the Conservatives in 2019. But when it comes round, like, the other way, when it's Labour that are benefiting from Tory voters staying home, the narrative always remains the same. It's like, well, it's not Labour winning. It's just, you know, Tory voters are staying home. No, fuck that. It's either one or the other. You can't pick and choose. So to go back to Joe Biden and Donald Trump, I think what I'm saying is that Biden was able to secure the White House. Firstly, he got more votes than Donald Trump in the popular vote, right? So that's fine. I believe that Democrats always do, or usually always do. So he won in that respect. But also, he won on the basis that people were voting against Donald Trump rather than that they were vociferously passionate and excited about what a Biden agenda might mean for them. Now that he's been in power for 4 years, nobody's voting like for him because they're excited about him or his agenda or anything, but they're also not like voting for him because they're voting against Trump, because Trump isn't actually in the White House at the moment. However, what we will hopefully see, you know, in my opinion, is that as we get closer and closer to the 2024 election over there, we're going to begin to see people actually greeted with the reality or the future reality of what a Trump 2.0 presidency might mean for them. You know, the upending of democracy. Like, here's the thing I always come back to. It's like, if Biden wins, or if Biden steps down and Kamala Harris steps up and she's the nominee, or if, like, some other sort of upstart challenger appears, if there is another Democratic term in the White House, things will just kind of carry on. Like, your life might not get better in Ohio or Florida or Michigan or whatever. It might not, things might not improve, but things won't get kind of worse, you know? If the Democrats get a second term, things will just sort of carry on, and then there'll be another election 4 or 5 years after that or whatever. If Trump wins the election, I truly do not know what the future of American democracy might look like. You know, that is the fear factor for me. And I appreciate how hysterical and probably radicalized that sounds. If you sit in conservative circles over in America, you might listen to somebody like me and go like, oh, come on. Don't be so melodramatic, man. It's not, it's just because he's not your guy. Just because you love Team Blue, you don't want Team Red. And, you know, don't be so ridiculous. You're being hysterical. People called people like me hysterical before the January the 6th riots. When people like waving Dixieland crosses and climbing into Congress and like, hang Mike Pence, hang Mike Pence. And people like me were like, you see? And then for all of 3 weeks, the Republican Party and all of its offshoot and like supporting journalists, all of the apparatus, everybody within that whole ecosystem, for about 3 weeks, they were like, yeah, yeah, okay. Well, I mean, that did get a little bit out of hand there. We'll look into that. And to give them their due, you know, they did. They did pause and reflect and seriously consider what that sort of leader and that sort of conduct might mean for their party and for the Constitution and for democracy itself and for the future of their country. They did stop calling us hysterical and pause and reflect just long enough until they looked at the polls and they were like, oh wait, he could still beat Biden, really? Oh yeah, he's our guy, you know. If we want to get back in and reopen the oil fields and funnel cash out to the offshores and award lucrative government contracts to Halliburton, oh well, I mean I don't like it, but you know, they did pause. They did pause and reflect and stop calling us hysterical just long enough until it might have caused them some mild discomfort in the coffers of the Republican Party. And, you know, and then at that point, they returned to form like fucking gremlins in a midnight bath. Here's a weird question for you guys. You know, I like those, right? Veteran listeners will be aware that I like to table these sort of, you know, hypothetical questions of just how bad things could get. So, here's my question for you guys. And again, this is not a transactional conversation. This is not a radio phone-in. This conversation is one way. Cannot stress that enough. Do not talk back to me or answer me. People will think you're insane listening to me while you're jogging on the treadmill in the gym. You're not talking to... It's not... I'm not actually there. Anyway, here's my question for you. If Trump does get in, and if he's not in jail, running the United States from a prison cell, like a fucking, you know, mafia boss or some shit, if he is the president when Labour are in power over here. Like, do you remember when he was in power before? Just try to remember that for a second. I mean, he was always a bit full-on fash, wasn't he? He was already demonising the press in his first term as president. Remember when he referred to, like, the New York Times as, like, the failing New York Times? He's like, man, it's very sad. It's very sad. It's failing. You know, it's failing. It's very sad what's happened to the once great paper, the failing Washington Post, he called it as well. Do you remember all of that? Demonizing the press. He would publicly lambast CNN for asking him just awkward questions, challenging questions. Whereas then he would go away and he would talk exclusively to Fox News and Newsmax and Piers Morgan. Like anyone whose most taxing question to him, the most challenging question that they would ask him would like, they would start at what, like his favorite lollipop flavor, and they would stop at, you know, whether he fancied a blowjob. That was the start and finish of how difficult the questions were from his chosen media outlets that he wouldn't disparage as fake news. Like, if he gets in again, I promise I'm getting to the question. If he gets in for a second term, post January the 6th, all of that, and if he defunds or prosecutes the people who have prosecuted him, you know, like, after all of this, after all of the indictments, if he seeks revenge on them, like, I'm going to send you to jail, you know? I don't think it's unreasonable to wonder if he might go after the American press thereafter. You know, like these district attorneys that are seeking to jail him or bankrupt him, if he goes after them in revenge, then after that, he goes after the American press, I think. Do you think that could happen, dear listeners? Could you see President Trump back in office seeking to shut down the Washington Post or heavily regulate the New York Times, CNN, MSNBC? You know? Do you think that could happen? Because here's my fear. Here's what I'm actually wondering, right? It's like, once he's untempered by a critical press, and once people aren't hearing about the awful shit that he's getting up to, what do you think he would do? You know, what do you think he's capable of? How bad do you think Donald Trump might get for this previously fascist adjacent character? How bad could he get once the like pit bull is off the leash, once he's no longer reined in by the American press? Like, if insurrection is what happens when he's on the leash, you know, if rape trials and corporate fraud are what happens when he is governed and reined in by the press, how bad do you think he might get when he's not? Like, could you foresee him jailing dissident journalists? Because I think I could. Is he going to have people disappeared? You know, Putin style? Will a mildly critical blog or podcast get you jailed under national security laws? How bad could he get? And most of all, the most urgent question of all for my listeners, if you assume that he does get really bad, if he is no longer reined in by the press, if he is off the leash to do pretty much whatever he likes, and things get incredibly bad over there, authoritarian, people getting jailed and disappeared, it just descends into a dystopian, post-democratic nightmare. The most urgent question of all, what will the cut adrift leader of the opposition from an island of wilting geopolitical influence do about it? Why won't Keir Starmer call for a ceasefire? Trump isn't even wearing a poppy over there. What is Starmer gonna do about it? Guys, that's it. That's all I've got time for. Please do consider jumping on the Patreon if you are enjoying 2, 3, 4 of these episodes in a row. It really does help to boost up the money that I've got to invest in the equipment to put on live shows and so on. There's loads of benefits as well. You can get exclusive access to the episodes of the podcast 2 days before everybody else. You can plummet into your Spotify or your Apple Podcasts directly with this little RSS feed, so it's still in the same player. Or you can use the Patreon audio player, that's fine too. I'm in a Discord chat, like a little private instant messaging thing with all of my Patreons. I pop in there every day, say what's up. We talk about politics, life, love, and the universe. What else? I'm doing meetups. I've done a couple of them in Brick Lane in London. I would love to do more, like up and down the country. So the more Patreons I get, the greater my ability to be able to buy the tickets and get an Airbnb and all that stuff. I'm also giving tickets out to Patreons, like a ticket link for you guys to get tickets for any live shows. So I did my one on the 28th of September. I've got the Riot Society this coming Friday night in London, in Tower Hill. Tickets for those always go out to Patreons first, so they can get first dibs before they sell out. Although, having said that, there's still like a handful of tickets for Tower Hill available now. So if you do want to come to that, jump on funk27.co.uk/shows. What else is on the Patreon? Oh, yeah, no, I'm doing like monthly, well, sort of ish monthly, like Skype calls, one-to-one with people who jump on the higher tiers. So if you want to chat with me, a beer on, I was about to say a beer on like a Tuesday or Wednesday night when I'm out here. Maybe I won't be doing beers in them anymore, which would be weird. I have to get the conversation flowing with some other sort of social lubricant. Maybe I'll just get stoned. I don't know. Maybe that's not any healthier, Aid. How about you just do some push-ups and enjoy your orange squash? Just try and settle down with the toxins. Anyway, look, if you do want to jump on Patreon, it's patreon.co.uk. Patreon.com, sorry. /AidThompson with an I-N on the end. That's it from me. Big shouts to the Patreon backers. Thank you so much for continuing your support. I'm going to try and pre-record another solo show so it goes out on Friday night so everyone's got something. If not, then I'll speak to you guys next week on another solo show. Couple of guests booked and coming up, so I'm really excited about that. But until next time, keep it strictly hashtag Binfluencer. And of course, strictly hashtag Booch. I'm out this motherfucker.